Welcome back to the Physician Syndicate podcast. I am your host, Greg.
And I'm your other host, Ronak.
All right. Today, Ronak and I are going to jump into, we're going to fast forward through your startup journey as this AI prior authorization company CEO and co-founder. You're now jumping, let's say, 6 years, Ronak, and we've gone from literally nothing to, let's say, a nice round number, $100 million in revenue. My God, you've grown this company so nicely. And now you're looking, you're getting older, right? So let's say you're 42 years old and you're like, you know what? I don't see myself doing this for the next 10 years. I don't think we have an opportunity to go public. How can I develop an exit strategy around this company that has nice revenues, right? It's growing nicely. $100 million is nothing to sneeze at. You're making a fair amount of money as the CEO, but you're just getting a little bit tired. And I think you're ready to exit. So let's chat about that. How do you actually make that happen? What does that look like? Who are the people you want to talk to? And then we can also have that debate of, you know, the age-old debate. Do you go with a banker to help you, or do you go solo? Ronak, how's your day going?
My day's going well so far. Yeah, it's nice and sunny here in Philadelphia. Got a chance to sunbathe this morning a little bit, so feeling good. How about you, Greg?
It is surprisingly hazy up here for some reason. I was like trying to figure out, is there a fire? What is this? What is this coming from?
I think so. It's coming from Canada, and I think it is some wildfires out there.
Oh, okay. You know what? I didn't even realize that Canada was on fire.
But on the,
I've been
on the
so
upside,
busy
really does,
with other things.
Right. On the upside, this does nicely remind me of California. It makes me feel like I'm at home.
That's true. I remember my sophomore year at UC San Diego, there was like wildfires raging all over camp, not all over campus, but around campus. And it literally was like nighttime for like 3 days. It just looked like it was actually evening, even though it was, you know, sunny above the smoke. It was crazy. And I remember ash too. Like there was literally ash falling all around campus. Yeah, I do not miss those wildfires, to be honest. And it was very
honestly,
like startling. I was like, holy crap, why is it so hazy up here? But I guess, so if it's already there all the way down in Philadelphia, then it must be a pretty big fire.
Right. And I think like all breathing in all this ash is clearly not a good thing. This does make me kind of want to become a pirate and just live on a boat in the middle of the ocean. Don't have to worry about wildfires there.
Dude, do you know what so one of the rabbit holes I've gone down on Instagram is these people that are like sailing around the world and they take videos because they all have Starlink now. So they can stream and they can watch TV and do all these things. But they're like fascinating. I'm like, I wonder if I could actually do that. And there's one group of people that sailed from somewhere in Mexico and they're going all the way to, I think, either Hawaii or Australia. I can't remember. Literally like a trans-Pacific crossing. I'm like, that is nuts. I don't know if I could do that. It sounds cool, but that also seems like I remember studying in undergrad rogue waves. Do you know what rogue waves are?
No.
Yeah, so for those out there, I studied atmospheric and oceanic sciences at UCLA. And one of the things that the professor I worked with when I was an undergrad, he used to study rogue waves, which basically means like a wave that is encountered in the ocean that is two times the average or median wave size. So like if you're in the middle of the ocean and like the waves are typically, you know, 10 to 15 feet high, a rogue wave would have to be like 30 or 50 feet high. But there's like images of these like fishing boats all throughout the oceans around the world encountering these rogue waves. And so they're insanely big waves and they're just like, oh my God. So if you've ever like watched Deadliest Catch or something like that, you see a lot of huge waves over in like the Bering Sea. But anyways, that's a huge tangent. We'll probably keep it in this.
But like rogue waves, I think this is an important topic, especially if you're buying a yacht. And one reason you might buy a yacht is if you sell your company through an M&A. For a large amount
there
of money.
Go.
So maybe we should double click on M&A and just
bringing
see
it back.
How some of our entrepreneurs can make a little bit of money by selling their company.
And if anybody's interested in the type of yacht you should buy, I've daydreamed about yachts. There's some really cool, like all electric that use solar panels, and there's some pretty cool ones out there. Never going to buy a yacht probably, but that's okay. All right.
Probably,
so let's talk about probably. Let's talk about M&A. So what does M&A actually stand for? It stands for mergers and acquisitions, not murders and executions. If you're an American Psycho fan, great book, great movie. Don't tell me you haven't seen that, Ronak.
I have no idea what you're talking about.
Oh my God. Okay. American Psycho. It's a book. It's all about this basically like finance tech bro, not tech bro, but finance bro, who is played by, in the movie American Psycho,
Christian Batman. Bale.
Christian Bale. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Christian and Bale. He's literally, he's a murderer. He's like a serial killer that is also like a finance trader type of person. Fantastic book, really gory book. They do less gore in the movie, surprisingly. It's still a rated R movie. You need to go watch that movie. Fantastic. Especially you guys like horror movies. This is a good one for you. It's like a nice mix of finance and gore. But no, it's a scene in a bar where he's talking to a woman and she goes, oh, what do you do for fun? Or something like that. And he goes, murders and executions. But it's so loud that she thinks it's mergers and acquisitions. Anyways, yeah, that took way too long to explain.
Interesting.
But great movie, great book. Both read and go watch it. Okay, so M&A. Again, so let's level set. You are a founder of this AI prior authorization company. You got $100 million in revenue. You're in year six. You're looking to potentially sell the company. How the hell do you go about doing that? So honestly, if you're making $100 million in revenue, you've probably already met a lot of the people that are going to want to buy your company, more than likely. So a lot of times M&A interest comes from potential partnerships with other companies or just other companies, you know, corp dev teams will likely reach out to you to start to understand, you know, would you ever be interested in the future selling us your technology, your capabilities so we can add it into our larger company as sort of like a new product line. So typically, again, you will have met the players in this space by the time you've grown to that large of a company. They will know who you are if you're, you know, potentially raising tens, 20s, hundreds, millions of dollars for your company. They're going to know who the main players are because that's their whole job. So let's go into actually, maybe we'll explain what a corp dev does, mostly because those are the people you're going to at least initially start to work with for an M&A. So corp dev is corporate development. What they do is they're really trying to find new interesting things to plug into a company. And so typically it's an entire department. If it's a larger company like an Amazon, a Microsoft, a Google, it's going to be a pretty large department likely. And they might even specialize in different areas of, you know, corporate strategy. So from my example, right, like I reached out to usually like a VP person at a corp, like at a company with a corp dev department. So when you're a startup founder that has a company that large, again, likely they're all going to know who you are. And so usually, you know, when you're growing a company, you're going to create some kind of partnerships with larger players in the ecosystem because it's going to help you drive revenue and also create those relationships early. And so usually they'll also have, you know, maybe they'll even have like a check-in with you every 6 months to a year to understand like, where are you at? What is your mindset? Because a lot of times, you know, Paul Graham will say when you're building a company, like never meet with corp dev because their whole purpose is to acquire your company, hopefully earlier rather than later so they can pay a smaller price, especially if they know that what you're building is super strategic to what they're ultimately going to do. Ronak, I guess, do you want to jump in at all on kind of who are these corp dev people?
Yeah, I think corp dev is a really interesting function in a lot of it. I mean, their job is basically to understand the marketplace, what's out there and what could potentially be acquired and make what makes sense to acquire and join the parent company, right? So when you think about these large companies, everything from a Johnson & Johnson to a Google, there are specific employees out there that are trying to learn about the startup world and other companies. So Paul Graham, I respect him. I think he's very, very intelligent, but I would go the other way. Why not build those relationships? Why not have like a good back and forth with them? You don't necessarily need to go say, hey, buy my company on day one, but just make all these conversations, have some warm introductions to them so that way you can get to know them. So that way when it comes time to reach out to them, you can do it in a little bit more elegant of a fashion.
Yeah, I feel like it's similar to raising capital, right? Like you want to have some more warm relationships with VCs that you can then go to, you know, 6 months, a year and a half later to say, hey, we're actually ready for our Series A. We're just starting the process now. Do you want to go get coffee somewhere? Like that's a lot easier than having to build a relationship from scratch when you're ready to go out and raise capital or sell your company. Also, a lot of people when they're, you know, looking to potentially sell their company will actually do two things at the same time. They'll say, let's say that you raised a Series B 2 years ago. You've been fine. You had a lot of money in the coffers. And you're like, okay, now it's time to either sell my company or go raise another round of capital. So you could start your Series C raise process at the same time while you're starting to float kind of the information over to the strategic corp dev people that, hey, I'm actually maybe interested in selling the company now instead of raising a Series C, taking more dilution and running the company for an additional few years to eventually maybe I can try to get to an IPO. And so if you do those two processes at the same time, it actually is an interesting way to create a little bit of urgency within that corp dev team and that strategy team to say, well, if we can't get a deal or a term sheet to this company, they'll probably go out and raise this Series C and maybe it values them at $1 billion, which would then put this company out of reach for what we're trying to do, because maybe, you know, if they're valuing it at a $1 billion valuation, those investors are going to want at least a 2 or 3x on that last round. And we're not going to be able to pay $3 billion for this company, even though we think it's a high strategic value target. So that's kind of the calculus you have to do in your mind as a founder is, you know, how do I create a little bit of leverage, a little bit of FOMO, especially if all you're interested in doing is selling the company at this point, is you need to either get interest for an additional funding round that's going to make your valuation skyrocket, or you go and find multiple bidders for this company to actually take it in and acquire it.
Yeah. So Greg, I think there are sort of three ways that an M&A can typically happen. So one is an acqui-hire, where the acquiring company is buying up a company just to hire the talent. You know, we've seen in the past a shortage of software engineers. And if, as a startup, you've been able to have it build a team of like 10 really great software engineers, people might just want to buy the company just to get the talent. Those usually return the least for investors because they don't really care about the investors. They just want to get the talent and that's it. There's no other aspect of the company that they really care about. The second is going to be when they're sort of like a, the second type of acquisition, I would say, is when the parent company or the acquiring company is feeling threatened. And I think, Greg, what you talked about is really interesting of like creating that buzz about raising a round of financing, as well as talking to companies about a potential acquisition. This is where things get really interesting. So my dad, maybe we'll bring him on the podcast at some point. He used to be in the venture capital space and the entrepreneur space. And he would always tell me that companies are not sold, they're bought. And the way that you can get the highest price when you're selling your company is if the acquiring company is threatened by what you are doing, right? So, you know, we've heard in the past that Facebook tried to buy Snapchat. Snapchat was getting all these younger users to migrate over to their site instead at a very steady clip. At the same time, like you were saying, Greg, they started raising money at $1 billion, $2 billion, $3 billion in valuation, right? So the thinking was not just so much that there, what is the threat today, but what does this threat become if they raised an extra $500 million? What else are they going to go build? They're already starting to take our users, and now they're going to go and accelerate that even quicker. They could like dry up our business in the next 2 years. This is a big threat. We got to do everything that we can do to stop them. We'll try to come up with a competing product, but maybe the simplest way is to just like offer them a bunch of money and see if they want to join our team, and they'll stop hassling us. So I think if you can threaten somebody, I mean, I hate to say this, this is a weird thing to say, but if you can threaten a giant company saying that you're going after their margins, you're going after their users, you're going after their bottom line, and really show that, that makes a really compelling case for somebody to acquire you. The last type of acquisition that I would talk about is if they're just looking for scraps and pieces, right? So, you know, maybe you've PE, that's right. That's right. The private equity, right? So like, maybe you've raised a bunch of money and you're getting zero traction. And if somebody comes in and acquires you and they liquidate, you know, whatever real estate you might have bought and, you know, some other equipment, and they can just sell that on the open market and maybe make a return on their investment, hey, why not? Or if you're just like running a very simple business, earning a little bit of money, and they just want those revenues and cash flows, you know, you're not going to get a huge multiple on those type of exits. But you know, they're there to be aware of, right? If you, especially as a physician, if you're running your own private practice, right, you probably can't go to Google and say that like my private practice in the pick your favorite medical discipline is a threat to you as a search engine. Probably not realistic. But, you know, if you do go to a private equity firm and say that, hey, my cash flow is XYZ, this is how it's been growing over time, it's pretty steady. You come in, you buy me out, and you get all that future cash flow, right? That's a legitimate way to go about it too. That sounds realistic.
And when you think about kind of the ultimate, you know, payout that you're going to receive as a founder, the highest amount that you're going to get is likely for going to be from a strategic acquirer that is doing it because, like Ronak said, they see you as a threat, because they're going to be willing to pay you a revenue multiple that's probably a lot more than anybody else is going to pay. Like, nobody's just going to like acquire you for 30 times your top line revenue or something like that. And a private equity firm is definitely not going to do that, because they're doing their internal calculation of saying, okay, we're going to buy this software company that is making $100 million in revenue, and we're basically just going to streamline the crap out of that company and then potentially flip it to somebody else at a much higher valuation because we've, you know, basically increased your EBITDA. Like, they're thinking about it in a very different way than a potential strategic acquirer is, where versus somebody that's just like, we want to hire your engineers or your ML experts in this world. Like, and you actually, like, there's people that will do a calculation that says, okay, you have 10 software engineers, we're going to value them each at $1 million. It's a $10 million acquisition, because all we're trying to do is get those people into the company to, you know, do other projects that we want them to do. So yeah, you can think about those in like a decreasing order of who you ultimately want to sell to. If you can find 3, 4, 5 different potential strategic acquirers for your company, you're going to be able to increase that valuation higher and higher until somebody says, you know what, that's just too high for me to pay. And in the market in 2021 and 2022, you saw companies going likely for 50 times revenue, which is like insanely high when you look at the public markets and like what comps are today. It's very, very different, which is why M&A activity has slowed so much. And the same thing with the IPOs, like it's slowed so much. But again, when you have multiple competing offers to play against each other, that's when you can really increase what your ultimate reward is going to be. And then you get to decide, okay, I can sell my company again. Let's use the $100 million in revenue. Let's say you get a 15X on that revenue. So you're going to sell the company for $1.5 billion. Great. Love it. That's fantastic. But then you can also go back and look, okay, I have, you know, 5 term sheets for the Series C because our revenue is growing so quickly. And maybe they're evaluating you at $2 billion. So then it's like you have to kind of think through, should I take the capital to continue growing the company, or am I done? Like, this is the ceiling that I'm going to reach as a founder. $1.5 billion for me, my team, my investors is a fantastic exit, knowing that we've only raised a Series B and maybe you're diluted, you know, down to 20% or something as the founder, and your investors are going to get a fantastic, you know, return on their investment. Everybody wins in that situation. That's the kind of mental math that you're going to have to do to figure out, do I keep going and really approach that IPO, or do I sell a little bit early to a strategic acquirer, knowing that maybe I'm leaving a little bit of money on the table, but I'm also not diluting in this next round of funding?
Yeah, and I would also think about, from a more tactical standpoint, I would think about M&A as just another version of sales, right? So on a previous episode, we talked about some of the very interesting sales tools that you could use as an early stage startup founder to get your first customers, get your first investors. There's no reason why you can't use these same tools to start building up relationships with people on the corp dev teams of some of these larger companies, right? So again, if you are creating a medical device company or something in the healthcare space, why not start, you know, sending out emails, just letting the corp dev folks at Pfizer and Johnson & Johnson and Stryker know who you are and what you're all about, right? Like, take a 30-minute coffee meeting with some of these folks and just start building up those relationships. And the way you can get in contact with them, get their email addresses, get their LinkedIn accounts, go back and listen to our sales podcast episode. I think there was a lot of good tools that we mentioned there.
Yeah, I think it's a very good point. Like, it is kind of a sales process, right? Like, selling your company to somebody else, it's just another transaction. It's, you can think about it in a similar way to like an enterprise sales. You know, it's going to take longer than just a small, hey, you're a small company, just use the software, we don't need to have 10 meetings. But it is a similar process. You go through the same thing. You go through due diligence. You have to send them a bunch of stuff. And it's also similar to raising capital. Like it's a kind of a mix of raising capital and selling your product. You combine those two and you do it with a bunch of really large players in the field. That's what it's like selling your company to a big company. And it's not entirely dissimilar. It's something that you can learn on your own. And that brings up the next kind of conversation to have is, do you go about this alone or do you hire somebody to help you shop the company around and potentially increase how much you're going to get on the back end in terms of a payout? So I will say that they don't do this for free, right? So actually, what is the term for these folks?
These are investment bankers.
Yeah, iBankers. Okay. So they cost a fair amount of money. Like it's, I think, 3-5% of the sales price is how much that they're going to take. It's almost like you get a new investor at the very last second that gets 3-5% of equity in your company, which I was not a fan of. I was like, no way. We've only given away like 1-point-something% or 2% in equity. I'm not giving away another 3. No way. So when I did that mental math for me with the sale of business, because I actually had previously built a little bit of a relationship with one person at an investment banking firm. And, you know, I brought up the fact that, hey, we're like going through the acquisition process. And he's like, oh, well, let me wet my beak a little bit and help you guys out. And I was like, I really don't think that you're going to add. You would have to do the calculation, right? Like how much value would they have to add for it to make sense to hire one of these people? Like they're going to have to add an additional like 7-8% to the sale of the business in order for you to cover that cost and be out ahead after. So I don't know what your thoughts are, Ronak. Like I'm sure there's a lot of groups that are very, very good at this, but, and maybe it's different for a large acquisition, like a $1.5 or $2 billion acquisition, where if you get enough potential bidders on the company, you can really push the valuation up. But for us, it really felt like we can just do this ourselves. But again, I think it might be a different mental math depending on the size of your company.
Yeah, Greg, I think that's right. I think there's two reasons why you might want to hire an investment banker. One, if for whatever reason the transaction is more complex and that could be a substantially larger company, I think it's probably a good idea to get that help. You know, when you sold FlipMD, you had less than 10 employees. If you had more than like 500 employees, the level of complexity and the negotiations and everything else is probably quite a bit more. The second thing that I would say is that I think for every entrepreneur that's looking to sell your company, you have to be a little bit honest with who you are and what your strengths are, right? So if your strengths are more on, let's say, the scientific side, and you and your team have put together a fantastic patent and got it issued, and this is going to be very, very monetizable in the future, but you don't have the sales gene in you, you're very nervous about reaching out to anybody new, you don't like taking calls, you don't like building up these relationships, you know, nobody's going to magically just walk up to you and throw $1 million at you, right? That might be an instance where hiring an investment banker or somebody like that is a good idea, because they can go and actually make these relationships that we're talking about, get in front of the right people, start having those conversations. However, if you do have the sales gene in you, right? If you are that type of person that's okay taking Zoom call after Zoom call and just like putting yourself out there, you're okay with rejection, then why give up 5% of your company, right? You can do that yourself. So I think it really depends on, you know, just look at yourself, look at your business, look at your co-founders. Do you guys have the right stuff to be able to go sell your company yourselves? If so, save the money. If not, pay up the money, because you probably will get a much better acquisition price if you hire a professional than if you try doing it yourself.
Yeah. And the other thing to think about with the investment banking piece is they have preset relationships with a lot of the potential buyers of a company like yours. And it's just going to be easier for them to reach out and be like, hey, I have this new company that I'm working with. Here's their revenue. Here's the strategic value to you, versus you having to do it all of that by yourself. But I think it's similar to like, what type of person are you as a founder? Are you the person that's like, I'm willing to go do the work by myself to save myself a little bit of money in the end? It's similar to like when I think about like washing my car, right? I can wash my car myself, or I can go down the road and go to the actual car wash and have them do it. It's like, I've gone both ways sometimes. I'm like, I don't have the time. I'm going to go let them do the car wash. if I have the time and my daughter is begging me to wash the car because she loves to wash the car for whatever reason, which I love, then we're going to do it ourselves. So think about it in the same way, just at a huge scale, right? Like, are you going to save money on the acquisition? Potentially. But you're also giving up a little bit of the upside potential too, right? Like, if you're not as good at negotiating as an investment banker who has skin in the game, like when you think about it, like their skin in the game is, I have a percentage now of this company. And the higher that I push that valuation, the higher my payday is. So it's, I don't know. I feel like if I had a bigger company that had a lot more revenue and a really, really high valuation, like a $1.5 billion, I probably would have gone with a professional, to be honest, thinking that maybe they can increase that by 100 or 200 million to really push the revenue multiple. Sure, I would definitely do that. But then it's like, if they don't, and it's like, well, maybe I brokered the first deal and it's like the same deal, but now they're just involved, I'd be pretty mad, because then you're giving away $50, $60 million. Like, that's a lot of money. I don't know, man. It's an interesting debate. Either way.
Yeah, Greg, while we close out this episode, let's touch on one more topic. And I think this topic is going to be a little bit near and dear to your heart. A lot of times when you negotiate an M&A deal, you're thinking, what is the dollar amount? But companies can typically pay you in two ways, either giving you cash or equity in their company or some combination of the both. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah. So this happened to us, right? So it was a cash and stock deal. We actually pushed in the negotiation to have the cash go up and the stock go down, which was a good thing for us to do. So cash, you know exactly how much you're getting. If it's an all cash deal, $1.5 billion, you know exactly what's coming to the bank account. That's great. If it's a cash and stock deal, then you know how much cash is coming in. But that stock that you're getting in that new parent company that now owns your business, it could go up, it could go down, it could stay the same. And for us, it went down. It went down dramatically after, you know, the acquisition went down probably 80, 85%, which hurt. It's like, well, now there's really no financial incentive for me to stay at this business because the stock is almost, it's not worthless, but it's pretty low compared to what I thought going in it was going to be worth. So if I'm a founder that's in that position again, I would push for more cash if I could, unless it's a stock that you're like, I'm really excited to own that stock. And maybe I want to own that stock for the next 30 years. If it's an Apple, if it's a Google, if it's an Amazon, if it's one of those, you know, Magnificent Seven, I think they call them, stocks, I'm fine with that. If it's a cash and stock deal or if it's a full stock deal, I'm probably going to be fine with that. If it's one of those blue chip stocks that you're pretty confident in the leadership that, you know, even if it goes down, give me 3 to 5 years for it to go back up. Sure, feel pretty comfortable with that. If it's a smaller company, it's a public company, let's say, because, you know, we're talking about kind of the stock aspect of it, then you need to do that calculation in your mind of saying, okay, maybe I'm getting a lower valuation with another company, but I'm more confident in that company, ultimately taking what I've built over the last 6 years. It's another one of those mental calculations that you have to make in your mind of, you know, maybe the deals are the same in terms of the cash component, but maybe part of the stock is lower on one of them, but you believe in that stock a little bit more. So I think it's all just kind of like relatively, it's a big guess. It's a big gamble, right? Like figuring out which offer to take, which one's ultimately going to be better in the end. You're never going to know until the next, you know, 5-10 years, which one ultimately was the better deal. And if you're going through that and that's like your biggest concern, you're doing pretty well.
Yeah. And Greg, I was really glad to see that you took a combination of both stock and cash. I think that's a nice way to hedge your bets. I'm glad it wasn't just all stock. That would have been a little bit of a nightmare.
Oh yeah. 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 I mean, yeah, if you took all stock, you're really gambling on that company. That is the gamble, right? And it's similar, like if it's an all stock deal with like within a private company buying another private company, you have to really believe in that private company and that CEO that they're going to be able to make your stock in that new entity much more valuable than it is when you got in. So if they're going for an IPO and you're like, well, they're pre-IPO and then the market crashes and you're like, well, now what happens? Who knows? Like some of these companies might end up failing. They might not be able to raise capital in a Series D or Series E because standards are really, really high. And if the IPO window is closed long enough, then it might be a really difficult time for a company like that. So Yeah, I mean, it's all very individual, and it's an interesting process to go through it. And I can only imagine it being like a much, much bigger acquisition to go through something like that. And I can imagine the lawyer bills going up exponentially. So anyways, yeah, that was a nice little conversation on M&A, mergers and acquisitions. Sorry, Ronak, you really need to go watch that movie. Again, any questions, anything you guys want us to cover on the podcast, reach out to us, Greg or Ronak at physicians.vc. Sign up for the newsletter. We'll have it in the show notes. And we'll also have American Psycho in the show notes as well. All right, Ronak, anything else?
Nope, that's it. Thanks, everyone.
All right, see you next time on the Physician Syndicate.
Thank you for tuning in to today's episode. As always, we'd like to remind you that the information and opinions expressed on this podcast are for educational and entertainment purposes only and should not be construed as financial or investment advice. Before making any investment decisions, we strongly recommend that you consult with your lawyer, tax professional, and financial planner. Keep in mind that investing in startups can be extremely risky, and there's a potential for loss of your entire investment. Remember to always conduct thorough research and consider your risk tolerance before making any financial decisions. Stay informed, and we look forward to having you join us on our next episode of the Physician Syndicate podcast.